The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 24th of September, 2020. On the podcast today, Ian Strapper-Taylor, CEO, and Richard Cooper, CFO of the Equals Group, that's EQLS, discuss the resilience of their B2B focus model in their interim results and express their confidence about the outlook going forward. Also on the podcast, Hervé Delany, Chief Financial Officer of SafeStay, talks about how they responded to the challenges faced in the first 6 months of the year and why he's confident the next 6 months of the year. Plus, Al Sisto, CEO of Turn PLC, explains their investment strategy and goes over the highlights from the interim results. And Chris Bailey, founder of Financial Orbit, covers news from the following companies: Cineworld, Pets at Home, Funding Circle, First Group, and National Express. And as always, at the end of the podcast, I have two lists for you: the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. A very important metric. You know, when someone hits a follow button, it means they have interest in the company, they may be investing and researching. So worth looking at that list all the time. Also, top five most liked RNSs I'll be covering. And you can check out both these lists, in fact, top 10 versions of both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll see lots of other content, including an update there from Block Energy, an article there, and from SafeStay, an article for Newformix. There's also a video there and a podcast, blog, Alba Minerals investment presentation, and of course, top of the page, COVID-19 index. The biggest riser there today on that index is Tech Capital, up 26% to 14.5, and the biggest fall of the day is Open Orphan, down 10% to 16.75 pence. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Ian Strapper-Taylor, CEO, and Richard Cooper, CFO of Equals Group, that's EQLS ticker. Guys, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having us, Justin.
Now, you've released your interim results, and we're going to dig into that and see what's happening there and just look at the last 6 months up until the 30th of June. Before we do, Ian, you used to come on the podcast regular. Must have been a couple of years ago, but different name. The company's changed. So explain, if you could, Equals Group. What is it all about?
Yes, absolutely. We've completely changed the company in many ways. When we last spoke, it was a couple of years ago. It was very much what we call B2C, or retail consumer focused, built around a travel money card, doing FX as a consequence of acquiring those customers. Mm-hmm. And we recognized back then that we had to evolve and move into the B2B space, so dealing with corporate customers rather than retail as our focus. So that's what we've been doing over the last couple of years, and the name change fits in with that. But FairFX, which we still use as a brand name on the retail side.
Yeah.
FairFX was known as what I just described, and Equals is the B2B iteration of that business. So what we have now effectively is integrated currency solutions for SMEs. SMEs are our target, but built on bank-grade infrastructure. So we are literally have better infrastructure than most banks in terms of clearing payments. So when you put that foreign currency expertise and together with that settlement capability, you've got something quite unique.
Yeah. So explain why you went to B2B and why you focus on that sector now.
In some ways, due to competition, we pioneered the concept of using a travel money type vehicle for acquiring customers to sell other things. And then you got some competitors, Mondo, Revolut, people like that, that were took it to the next extreme. They would offer it for nothing to acquire customers. Mm. And with our ownership base, we simply can't compete with that type of pricing. So we had to move to another sector.
Yeah, but will that competitiveness, will that follow you into the B2B, or is there more barrier entry to there?
For sure, there's going to be more competition. But we have a lot of advantages. Not even if you have unlimited funds, to assemble what we've assembled in terms of clearance capabilities takes time. Time is the real barrier. It will take you a couple of years to get to where we are in terms of direct interface to the Bank of England, clearance accounts there, and settlement capability via faster payments.
Okay, and so, in fact, while you clear your throat there, Ian, we'll talk to Richard. So, Richard, you can take us through the figures, of course. This is for the 6 months ended the 30th of June. Of course, we've gone through that awful period where everyone was in lockdown and pretty much a lot of businesses just stopped. So, take us through some of the figures, if you could, Richard.
Of course. Well, I'll just start with a little bit of a history lesson. So, in the first half of 2019, the business was doing, you know, 13.6 million of revenue, 5.3 of gross profit, and an adjusted EBITDA of just under 2 million, but with some quite lumpy IT rebuild costs and other things that were costing us about 4.4 million. Mm. We did some acquisitions in the international payment space. In the beginning and mid of the second half, and that drove our revenue up to 17.4 million with a higher gross profit and a decent adjusted EBITDA, but also with some exceptionals and capitalization. And the capitalization really reflects the rebuild that took place, which has positioned ourselves for so much better for this year. So there was 8 million spent last year on capitalization and, 3.9 million on various management exceptionals, including the rebranding. Mm. So taking us through now to the first half of this year, despite the COVID headwinds, we did 13.8 million of revenue, so higher than last year. The mix has obviously changed. International payments last year was 4.8 million. This year is 8.2 million. It's a very, very good margin. 76% of the international payments business is B2B. And therefore, we have really pivoted away from being a travel money business. A year or so ago, I think we would have had something like 50% being travel money. Now it's less than 15% exposed to travel money. And the bulk of our international payment customers are entrepreneurial businesses. We are the same. We feel we can talk the same language to those businesses as well. So when... before COVID hit, we were doing something like 126,000 revenue a day. We were obviously hit badly with COVID, like most other people. It dropped about 93K a day in the second quarter. It's bounced back to around 114K a day now. And in the tail end of last year, the fourth quarter of last year, we did 132K per quarter. So that just goes to show what we can do. And what we are anticipating doing. Our cost base is remarkably simple in a way. We have staff. We had at our height 337 staff. We've now got a run rate in sight of 280, and it may go down lower. Staff cost represents around 80% of our cost base. We have some properties. We've got IT spend naturally. We've got professional fees and we've got a little bit of travel and entertainment. So it's a pretty simple P&L in a way. The gross profit margins are a very, very important guide, however, to our success. We make plus 63% gross profit margin across all our business lines. Banking and international payments are better in terms of their gross profit. Banking, not least because it has a lower cost base because it's based up in Chester, and that's clearly what we look for and look to try and optimize those gross profits. The bulk of the cost between the revenue and gross profit is either affiliate marketing or commission payments, the dealers here and their cohort of fellow staff are on a sales commission. Eat what you kill, and that means that it is really quite capital light that bit of the business.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say there. I mean, probably one for you, Ian. But so, how do you acquire your clients, your customers, and what differentiates you from the competitors then?
Good question. And in fact, part of what we announced in this statement was much more focus on the sales side of the equation. First of all, you have to have products that you can sell. And second of all, you need to get them into the hands of customers. And historically, on the retail side, you know, we used marketing, TV ads, and that sort of thing. To acquire business customers is completely different. We have a far clearer defined sales strategy now. We've attended to every bit of the funnel, if you will. So right from lead sourcing through conversion, onboarding, to smooth out, you know, reduce a bit of friction in each bit of that, then you acquire more customers and you will convert more of them through the funnel. Mm. Key to that is a better CRM system. So we're in the process of putting in a much better one. Historically, we've recorded details of customers we've added, but less details about customers we didn't add and the reasons why. And actually, that's in some ways more important information because it informs what you need to build, what you need to change. So literally, you're getting from customers that you don't win what you need to build in order to win them. That's all driven around data. So data is, we've built up a far better data team than we had. The initial focus of our data team was more on the financial reporting side of it. It's now firmly pointed towards that whole discipline of sales and marketing. So some of it is outbound sales. Some of it, as Rich has alluded to, will be affiliates and affiliate marketing. You can get it. Our target customer is basically the CFO or financial controller or MD of an SME that has currency exposure, typically between 50 and 500 employees. That's our sweet spot. That's what we build stuff for. And that's where we're targeting to get into. Why people would use us rather than anyone else. And let's remember, the business in this space still sits with the banks. Let's not forget that. We need to win business off banks. Banks don't look after SMEs well at all. I think we all know that. they'll use us because we can combine fantastic platforms, self-serve, you know, do-it-yourself platforms for foreign exchange with numerous solutions within it, with this bank-grade settlement capability and bank-grade current account capabilities. Very few people can do that. Banks have that, but they don't serve it up in a very user-friendly way. So we believe we have a unique proposition in that space. So hence why we'll go at it hard.
Yeah. And, you know, COVID, not with COVID standing here, because we don't know when. I've heard several people say, you know, vaccine's going to be here in the next month, before the end of the year, for vulnerable groups, whatever. So we don't know when it'll get back to the normal, or the normal that we know it, or new normal. But so what kind of...
Justin, I think that's a good point in that what markets hate, and so do businesses. You know, forget the, you know, FX markets for a minute. Businesses hate uncertainty. Yeah. And, you know, we have had in the UK over the last 4 years a load of uncertainty over Brexit, So which didn't help. In theory, we had certainty in December of last year, and it's no coincidence we had a massive month in December, you know, after the election. And then now we've got two lots of uncertainty. And then once we get clarity on either or both, things will pick up rapidly. And for now, if you can delay a decision, delay a payment, whatever, as a business, you're going to delay it. So there's not as much activity is suppressed.
Yeah.
So we're sort of, you know, I can see a real big tick up in business as soon as you get more clarity on both those issues.
Yeah. And do you dare, you know, set any sort of operational or financial goals yet?
We do internally, obviously. Mm. We're treading a delicate line. What we don't want to do is come out with some numbers. Yeah. And then miss them,
yeah,
even if it's not our fault because of macroeconomic events. So we're being cautious on that score. We obviously have various scenarios planned out. Myself and Richard have, you know, forecasts out to 2022, but we don't want to share those right now because you just can't be sure. So what we are doing, and hopefully investors and potential investors are seeing this, in the RNS and everything that we do is providing way more transparency financially, way more disclosure, very clean understandable set of accounts. And the RNS for an interim statement was very long, deliberately so, to provide that sort of increased window into what we're doing so people can draw their own conclusions, and their own conclusions are pretty sensible. So that's how we're doing it for now. If everyone in the market starts producing guidance, and that's what we need to do, we can do it literally in 24 hours. It's not hard because we're doing all that work, as you might expect.
But I would say that, you know, we have a laser-like focus on two particular things. The first is product robustness and ease of use for our customers. And the second is cash break even, which is highly unlikely, or not highly unlikely, highly unusual for a fintech. You know, we want to stand on our own two feet, which we are doing. And that we think will make us a much more valuable proposition.
Excellent stuff. Okay. Well, listen, guys, every day on the podcast, I highlight the top five most followed companies on the Vox platform. To get on that list, of course, people have to hit that follow button and add you to their watch list because they're liking what you say, or, you know, doing more research, or even investing in you. So if, you know, to get on that list, please give us now, Ian, if you could, three reasons why someone should add you to their watch list, please.
I love it when Justin does this, you know, out of nowhere. First, we are in a fantastic space. You know, this is a space that is enormous, that is growing. So fintech, fine, that's, you know, it's a big category. But B2B, the business segment of international payments, is a fast-growing space, and there is business to be had, massive amounts of business. And we have a unique skill set, or product set, I should say, in terms of, as I said, combining FX with bank grade current account functionality. And no one else has it. And you'll see more of this from us over the next few months in terms of not just direct market penetration, but also providing our infrastructure to other financial institutions. So not only can we access directly, but we can do it through other financial businesses, even banks. And secondly, as Richard just alluded to, you know, we are all over the cost side of this business. You know, we've got a lean business now that's fit for purpose, even in these difficult times. Richard and I go through the headcount religiously every single month with every single exec member. We've got a very, very strong control of cash as a consequence. And that's the last reason, is that as we sit here now, despite what people may have predicted, you know, we've got more than enough cash. It's not like we need to tap the market for business as usual. We're self-sufficient and can throw the worst of what Brexit and COVID-19 has been throwing at us. So, you know, we're in a very, very good place, and the perfect time for people to get on board.
Excellent stuff. Ian, Richard, thanks for coming on the podcast. Hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Justin.
Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Hervé Delany, Chief Financial Officer and Company Secretary of SafeStay. SSTY is the ticker there. Hervé, thanks for joining me.
Hi, good morning, Justin.
Now, you've had your results out. It's your, of course, half year report. And this is to the end of the 30th of June 2020. And what a 6 months it's been for the entire world. None of us could have predicted what has happened. So, you know, this is including all that period where pretty much a lot of businesses were shut down because of the COVID-19 pandemic. So we'll dig into that and ask you, you know, what your thoughts on the outlook is and where you are at the moment. Before we do that, as always, SafeStay, for people not familiar, just give them a brief summary if you could, Hervé.
Yeah, sure. So SafeStay operate hostels. Okay, the company was started in 2014 with one hostel in London, and since then we have grown the portfolio to 20 hostels in 12 countries. We have approximately 4,000 beds today in operation. Yeah. We have a nice safe product, and the particularity is that it's always located in the best location in the key cities in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's very much a premium offering. And like I said, I always say this to people, if you've never heard of this before and you have the word hostel in your head, my picture I conjure up is completely different than what I see on your website. Like, you go to your website and it looks like a very, very nice hotel. And so it's worth looking at. So it's a premium offering. So let's go on.
No, it is. You're right. It's exactly what you're saying. It's a premium offer. So even though we differentiate from the hotel offer by offering something which is a hostel with probably a bit more of a community sentiment, then it is still a very nice and premium product.
Yeah, exactly. And exactly, those communal areas where, you know, it's food and all that stuff. Okay, let's get into the results. So first of all, the results, 6 months, you know, what would you draw people's attention to in the results, Hervé?
Well, it was clearly an exceptional year for everyone, and including for Sexty. So, of course, this 6 months period would have been a bit different for us than the other ones. So, of course, we've had to close the hostels by the 1st of April, which means that we have only operated 45% of the bed stock during the period, and which means that our turnover was down 57% compared to the previous years. But if I may, I'd rather actually look at two things during this period, which is a bit of a more positive thing. Is first of all, if I look at the 2 months where we have operated before the crisis started, we were doing extremely well. At the time, the revenue was increasing by 30%. The underlying like-for-like growth was 15%. And I think that it's important to remember that the underlying strengths of the business were there before COVID and should be there afterwards. The other thing that I think that we should highlight is that we were actually good at controlling the cost and react quite promptly in March to reduce the cost base. So we've got negotiation with the landlords, negotiation with the bank. We took also the government grants where we could in the different countries. So the EBITDA for the period is a loss of 1.2 million against the profit last year. But it's a bit incredible to say that, but it's actually not too bad considering the circumstances, and the fact that we reduced the cost by so much has helped us to maintain a loss which is still sustainable.
Yeah, absolutely. And currently, you know, what is the trend under the current restrictions?
We have reopened all the hostels by the end of August, but for two. There are two hostels in London and Barcelona, which will open. We have some other properties in these cities, so we'll open when we see the demand can justify it. So we have reopened all the hostels. The most important thing really was to make sure that we would have all the safety protocol in place in all the hostels to protect the guests and the employees. So that's done. Though the good news is that we actually seen occupancy increasing week and week when we open the hostels. So there is a very positive trend of growing. Mm-hmm. Currently, we're operating between 25% and 30%. It's not yet there, of course. In a normal year at this time, we will operate around 80%. So, of course, it's not as good as it would be. But it's good in two things. First of all, this is what we had forecast. So our forecast was built on the 25-30% occupancy. So it's good to know that we are in line with what we've predicted. And the other thing, that 25% is really the point where it makes it worse from a financial perspective to reopen the hostels. So we're positive. It's encouraging. Of course, the next month, will be crucial for the rest of the forecast.
Yeah. And talking about forecasts and predictions, I know it's very hard now. We've been reminded of that, you know, no one predicted COVID-19. But what's your thoughts on customers coming back to hostels? Will they do it in the same way as they did previously, pre-COVID?
You know, there's a point which is very interesting, that there was always a feeling, it was more an intuition, that our clientele, due to our the demographic, the fact that it's essentially young travelers, would be resilient. And it's proving actually right. Where we thought originally that we would have essentially domestic demand when we would reopen the hostel, we discovered that it's not the case. I mean, these guys, 20, 25-year-old, they continue to travel, not just domestic. So provided that there is no travel restriction which prevents them from traveling, then they come back. And the fact that, as I've explained, we have a positioning which is premium, which is safe, and they can see that we've implemented all the safety protocols, and we have some excellent reviews about that on our website, then they do come back. So I'm very positive about the future, because this clientele, I think, is a resilient one. They will always come back, and we offer a very economical today proposition for them. So I have no doubt that that they are, and they will come back even stronger.
Yeah, well, no, I sort of agree. I just think, you know, like I said, you know, now we're in the middle of this COVID pandemic, or just coming towards the end of it, and many predictions this won't be here within 6 months. Vaccines will be widely distributed. I think almost pent-up demand will increase. I think, you know, more people will want to travel, because it's within, especially the demographic you pitch to. You know, people hate to be locked up. And that's what we've seen, teenagers in groups being fined on telly. They're meant to socialise, they're meant to travel, they're meant to it's a rite of passage, you know, and get out there. So I think definitely it'll come back, and I think it'll bounce back in leaps and bounds. But let's talk about funding. What are the funding options for the company at the moment, then, Hervé?
It's interesting, because it's a good timing. We have just agreed in principle with our bank, HSBC, to convert a 5 million overdraft, which we had secured at the start of the pandemic. We've converted that to a 5 million CBILS, government-backed loan, which offers them the same envelope, 5 million, but with more flexibility and a longer period, because the CBILS is for 6 years. So that's extremely good news. At the same time, we've also reviewed our covenants for the period up to Q4 2021. So we reviewed them to adjust them so that it would be more in line with what we achieve today. So that's another good news. The 5 million that I'm mentioning is very important, because under our forecast, on the best scenario that we disclosed in our interims, we will need roughly 4 million of cash at the peak of the crisis, when we hit our cash requirements around December, January. So these 5 million should allow us to see through the crisis. Now, we are sensible. We know that there is an uncertain market out there. So what we are doing also is that we are looking at alternative options. And the good thing when you're a listed company like ours is that, first of all, we are listed, we have access to capital. And the second aspect is that we have assets. We have freeholds, we have virtual freeholds, we have a net asset value of 48p per share. And what that gives is that gives the ability to either dispose of assets if we are short of cash, or leverage some assets, because we have some assets which are still unencumbered with debt. So that gives us ability, depending on the circumstances, to either raise additional funds, raise additional debt, or raise additional cash by selling the assets. So if I give a summary, that we have the 5 million which should see us through, and if it's not enough, then we also have alternatives which we have already started to investigate. So we're ready to action one of them, depending on the circumstances and the requirements.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And so if you can boil sort of, you know, down to one main objective for the company for this year now, what is it? What do you want to achieve? Evie?
Well, now that I've explained, we are the customers. I think that our customer base is strong. We are the funding to see us through the crisis. I think that we should never forget that before everything, we're a service company. So really, as a company, we should make sure that we refocus on the service that we deliver to the guests, so that we come back to the fundamentals and make sure that we are in the best position to make the most of these demands when we emerge from the crisis, hopefully in January, February next year, especially if we have a vaccine which will be made available for everyone at this time. So that's really the thing. And it circles back to what I was saying at the start of this interview, that we did very well at the start of 2020, and hopefully we will resume the same growth at the start of 2021.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, every day on the podcast, I highlight the top five most followed companies. To get on that list, of course, many people have to hit that follow button on your page, on the company's page. So to get on that list, please give us now three reasons why someone should hit that follow button on your page and add SafeStay to their watch list, please.
Well, I think that the first reason is probably an obvious one. It's our share price today. It's 13p, 1-3. And if you look at our NAV, it's 48p, as I say, underpinned by a strong asset. So that's a very good deal. And as I say, we'll see through the crisis. We'll be there in 6 months. So that can be only a good deal. The second aspect, as I said, is that we have the funding, we have everything, we have the guests. So we'll be there when everything is back. And probably the third thing is the management. We have the experience. I mean, sadly, we're old enough, the management team, to have been through that sort of crisis before. And we've shown so far that we knew how to react fast, promptly, and efficiently. So this management experience will probably make a difference during this period.
Excellent stuff. It's good to talk to you, Hervé. Hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Justin. Have a nice day.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Al Sisto, CEO of Tern PLC. T-E-R-N is ticker. Al, thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you, Justin, for having me on your program.
Yeah, well, you're well followed, and I'm very familiar with you, so it's nice to get you on the podcast. And news-wise, you've just released your interim results. 6 months ended the 30th of June, and we'll ask a bit about that, if you could. Before we do that, Al, if someone hasn't heard of you, can you explain what Tern is about, please?
Tern is an investing company listed on AIM. We've been publicly traded since about 2014, and the founders are the initial investors in this business. And what we do is we provide retail investors in particular with access to high-growth IoT companies through our investing in those businesses to get the returns and participate in businesses that we believe have high exit values, particularly in the U.S., where we also have a base of operations. So it's a unique investment vehicle for investors to take advantage of the new and fast-growing IoT market.
Yeah, yeah. And currently, what's the core of the portfolio? How many investments have you made?
Within the framework of the business, we started the business to qualify a name with three minority investments, of which we've exited two of those investments and still maintain a small percentage in a third. But the core, our principal investee companies, are four. Our flagship is Device Authority, Fundamental Virtual Surgery Company, Wild Networks, and NBMA. Those are our current four investee companies, which we have a significant position and positions on the board to influence outcomes and returns for our shareholders.
Excellent stuff. Okay, so your interim results, unaudited for 6 months, ended the 30th of June. Can you please provide us, Al, with an overview of the results, please?
The overview results are really a testament to the type of people we have in the companies that we've invested in. In this COVID environment, everything had to change. And change on short notice, and we were able to, with our companies, create a crisis management group of the CEOs share resources, share ideas, as well as, you know, take advantage of our synergistic qualities of the portfolio to, in effect, produce results that were up in revenues from the previous year-on-year time frame by 62%, but also in the time of COVID, and the problems created within the framework of customer relations, still add another 7% growth to the aggregate headcount within the portfolio. So, I think our results are a reflection of the relevance of our companies in the markets that they serve. Despite all the obstacles that were created during the period. And we signed a number of significant contracts with our companies in this period that I think are beachheads in future big opportunities to be leveraged as we somehow get back to the new normal.
Yeah. Yeah, before I ask you about the companies there, I mean, so do you feel at the moment it's getting easier? Do you think the worst is behind us at the moment?
I would be naive to say the worst is behind us because there's so much data that is still not really understood. Yeah. But I think with regard to the operational characteristics of our business, we have restructured these businesses to operate online, operate in this new Zoom Teams environment, as well as we've put an emphasis on managing the relationships with our existing customers and help them through the crisis such that we're able to get more share of wallet from those businesses and provide for continuous growth and value creation within the investee companies, as well as share resources. You know, there's an auto company that is a customer of Device Authority that was put into creating ventilators, of which they were struggling to figure out how to train the people to use these new ventilators, which are substantially different than the existing high-end medical devices that are the ventilators of practice. And we put together a deal with Fundamental, the surgical training company, to actually create training videos for the returning NIH workers to learn how to use these new products that are ventilators, but are substantially different. So, you know, this is the kind of tenacity that we have within the portfolio companies, as well as a camaraderie that we've created that I think, regardless of the new normal, we're well positioned to continue to improve results and improve value.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you just mentioned one there, but you do mention in the interims how your portfolio companies have solidified their leadership positions, you know, during the pandemic. Can you provide a bit more detail on that as well, Al?
I think if you look at the leadership positions, In particularly in the case of the Device Authority, they've been recognized by some of the industry analysts as in the top quadrant, you know, in sort of the magic quadrant area in terms of providing secure device lifecycle management and partnered now with companies like Microsoft and supporting and helping Microsoft customers take advantage of the Azure cloud. Fundamental has been recognized by the Academy of Surgeons and a number of different hospital groups, as well as from the investment point of view, the Mayo Clinic and the Sinai hospitals in Germany as a leading, if not the leading, virtual reality training for surgeons, particularly in an area of time when getting surgeons together to learn how to do surgery has become a very difficult chore. Mm-hmm. So they've created a almost Xbox-like multi-user capability to allow surgeons to practice surgeries on a virtual cadaver. So there's an unlimited supply of surgical bodies to practice on and do so in a collaborative environment. So, you know, these are things that the companies have done and have been recognized for in terms of making some supportive changes. And most recently, Wild has been recognized and is involved in doing some work with care homes in Scotland to provide for a level of care home tracking of patients and visitors and staff in a unique way using their mesh technology and LoRa technology that provides for this capability with anonymity, so that there is a compliant GDPR requirements as well as in the U.S. the HIPAA requirements. So, our companies, are being recognized as resources, as well as being recognized by industry groups as leaders in what they do.
Yeah. And can you tell us, a bit more about your investing strategy and how you attract sort of IoT startups, given the level of competition at the moment in that area and the VC arena?
I think what's happening is our investee companies are really the honeypot for other IoT companies to really want to work with us. Our investment strategy is really to go into organizations early days, in a seed round kind of environment where there's already a product established, but that product needs to have some of the rough corners removed, as well as a global strategy for deployments, particularly deployments into the U.S. And what we do is take an active position, in the 15 to 25% range, ideally 20%, at this early stage, and work to create new value, new proof points within these companies to attract additional investors and syndicate the deal at a full A round, where we'll participate, but our participation will be at a step up in value and recognition of the value that we created. That recognition of value that we created, and it was particularly obvious with our work at Fundamental Surgery, where we went in early days and then did a syndicated round with industry participants as well as financial investors like Downing. That helps us attract companies that wanted to have us do the same thing. We're all operating people. We've all run businesses. We've run startups. We've taken companies public. So we bring a different perspective to our investee companies, and we work with them regularly to provide advice as well as make connections through our networks. And that, I think, has been the real important aspect of our deal flow. The other thing was we added an additional investment partner who is just focused on making our brand well known within the startup community. So we're actively pursuing companies that we see, but companies, I would say the majority, more than 50%, 60% of our deal flow is companies coming to us right now, which is really rewarding and beneficial, because we don't have to spend a lot of time and money beating the bushes.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you recently raised $1.5 million. How do you plan to use the funds, Al?
Like with all our funds, fundraisers, they're targeted from investment. In March, we raised $800,000 and put $500,000 to work almost immediately. With this $1.5 million, we're looking at a number of investment opportunities that are in final due diligence that we believe, and as we said in the interim reports, we'll be making a new investment shortly, and potentially syndicating some of our one or two of our existing portfolio companies now through the end of first quarter.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, if we dare look forward, which, let's be honest, is if the pandemic's told us one thing, is not to predict the future, but what can shareholders expect from Tern in the remaining months of the year, given the challenges ahead?
I think the outlook is Tern will make a new investment, as well as one or two of our existing portfolio companies will bring in a syndicated partner so that we can unleash the value. One of the things that we do, which is very conservative, but I believe prudent, is we mark our portfolio carry value at the last third-party validated round of investment. So our syndication efforts are important to show and demonstrate the increase in value in a accounting measurable way for the shareholders. So our net asset value per share is based on the last round that was raised with third-party validation. So the syndications are important for us as well as for our shareholders and for the companies because they raise additional capital without us having to raise additional capital for some of those syndications. So we see a new investment and one or two syndications between now and the end of first quarter. And again, COVID makes doing due diligence extraordinarily difficult, as well as having syndication meetings extraordinarily difficult. So the timing is predicated on people's abilities to get together and move forward. But we have in the oven quite a few transactional opportunities, and we will execute on them to create more value for our shareholders.
Marvelous stuff. Okay, every day on the podcast, I highlight the top five most followed companies. So obviously, to get on those lists, people have to hit that follow button. So right now, give three reasons, if you could, why someone should hit that follow button on your page and add Turn to their watch list, please.
We provide shareholders, particularly the retail shareholder, with access to technology companies they wouldn't be able to invest in on their own, and then manage those investments for them in a way similar to a venture capital company, but with the ability to buy and sell shares every day. So we provide an instantaneous sort of measurement of our performance to those shareholders to have access to these companies. I think that's a really real novel approach to taking advantage of our ability to invest in companies, take them to the U.S. and exit with U.S. Values in terms of the multiples on the value in the business. I think the other thing is another key point here is that we are active participants in the companies we invest in. So we are not financial investors. You know, we are operational investors. So when you invest in Turn, you're providing us and yourselves with the ability to continue to work with the companies that we've invested in to turn them into bigger companies and bigger companies that have a lot more value than when it is we started with our investments. And lastly, I think, you know, we provide an avenue for these realizations, you know, in terms of our commitment to return a portion of any realization from these companies to the shareholders in some tax efficient way, either a dividend or a share buyback, for example. So this is an organization where you have VC like investments without a 10 or 20 year time frame, but much shorter, and with access to public information about these businesses and the ability to, you know, see and experience a realization and the returns from those realizations in short order.
Excellent stuff. Al, it's good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Very much. I enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for having us.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com. You all right, Chris?
Yeah, very good, thanks. Very good. Well, I say very good. I'm personally good, but let's face it, the market is not so happy. You know, sadly, you've had obviously the government's indications about a second wave and restrictions and everything else, and obviously that's been overhanging the market over recent days, not just in the UK but globally too. And obviously that's not so hot.
Yeah, it's a bit like our weather, Chris. You know, it's started off the week okay-ish, and it's gone downhill now. It's winter time. I'm almost thinking of putting the heating on in my office.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, I mean, well, it's always the way. They say, of course, that the winter months are the better months for the stock market, yeah. Right? You're supposed to get the better returns when people are focused on trading rather than going outside. Perhaps it's all been inverted with the coronavirus. Who knows?
One thing I think is going to go on here, I think I've been watching sort of, you know, they do a sort of CNBC, they do a report on all the big vaccine players. The nine big players pretty much were in, you know, phase three trials, and they're all saying, I think it's Pfizer at the lead at the moment, and they're saying they're hoping for results end of October, and they're looking quite good. And the others are going to be, you know, next couple of months after that. So I think once we get some positive news on a vaccine, I think that'll lift the markets, maybe temporarily. Of course, you still have a financial fallout for a while, but I think that'll lift the sentiment a bit, don't you think?
I think that's right. Markets, you know, they're funny beasts. They always look forward. We all know that. And clearly some people have got concerned, quite rightly, about what the profile of a second level of restrictions, not really lockdown, but restrictions might look like. My view is pragmatic in the sense that clearly it's much better not to have the pandemic, obviously, for multiple levels. But, you know, we can't predict vaccines, sadly. I mean, that's what the history of medicine and everything else tells us. But what we can do as individuals, and obviously at a corporate level, and even at a government level possibly, is to try to find mitigation tactics. And, you know, human ingenuity ultimately is something to back. And we faced a huge range of challenges over the last, you know, couple of thousand years or something, or more. And we've responded to them. And as a consequence, you've got to, I think, remain optimistic. And certainly from a purely, you know, commercial capitalist perspective, every company out there has an incentive to try to find workarounds and routes and methods to interact with their customers, do deals or whatever else it might be. But yeah, it's certainly difficult, and consequently that's reflected in the volatility of the market. Yeah. But ultimately, it's like anything, at a bigger picture level, we've got negligible interest rates. Cash in the bank is in real terms losing you money. Most bonds out there, corporate bonds, government bonds, are also just going to wash their face at best in real terms, you know, most of them. So where else are you going to go? What else are you going to do? Property market, you know, that's quite high versus income. So I would suggest good to own your home. I would completely agree with that. Do you want a second or a third one, really? Probably not. So what are you going to do? Backing companies, corporate endeavours, the future of business is not a bad place, particularly for longer-term pension fund money. Your pension fund, you know, it's, I mean, Buffett always says, you know, the best time to buy, you know, the whole buy low, sell high mantra is he actually likes as much as you can market falls on the basis that gives him an opportunity to put cash to work. Yeah. And that's how somebody with a reasonable time frame should be looking. I know it's not good when your investing portfolio goes down. It's not nice. Everyone doesn't like it. You know, even I, you know, schooled in 25 years of looking at these things, don't like it. But the reality is that's the markets. You know, you just got to live with it.
Yeah. Absolutely. And let's be honest, you know, property, it's quite illiquid as well. You can't just jump in and out. You can't move around funds, especially the private investors, you know what I mean? So I think it is the only game in town. Saying that, though, you know, you've got to be careful where you put that money, you know, because there's certain companies doing well at the moment. Like I said, the Amazons of the world are doing well, whereas certain companies can't even turn over any revenue because they're locked down pretty much. And what are you looking at today? I heard Disney World got some numbers out, haven't they?
Absolutely, that's right. And Cineworld is obviously the perfect embodiment, or one of the perfect embodiments of all of these challenges. The numbers today were, they weren't shocking. I mean, they were sort of as expected, really. I mean, yes, most of the cinemas are open, but when you're talking about group revenues, you know, last year at this time, they were talking about over $2 billion worth of revenues, and now they're scratching around for $700 million worth. And obviously that includes part of the time when trading was normal. So you can see the fact that the impact on the business, unsurprisingly, is running at a loss. And to add insult to injury, they've obviously got a bunch of debt as well. And even though they've raised extra liquidity, it ain't good. You know, the combination of debt and losses and troublesome business conditions, you know, that is a classic recipe for disaster. The reason the shares are down today is because they've given a little bit of guidance. And in their view, they can't rule out, Kelsey's raising some money to supplement and improve their balance sheet if conditions remain tricky. And the trouble is, overnight we had Disney once again pushing back another film. You know, they had some big film, Black Widow, whatever it's called, they plan to release before the end of the year. That's been pushed back into next year. And obviously, you're seeing that across a variety of the film companies. And that isn't good. You know, what a cinema chain wants is obviously consumers to have confidence to come into their facilities, number one. And number two, to have content to draw people into their facilities. And on both sides, Cineworld are struggling. So, yeah, the shares, you can see yourself, an absolute shocker over recent years. You know, expansion, debt-funded expansion at the wrong time. and now we'll see finally troublesome conditions. So I'm afraid money raising are coming, I feel.
Yeah, and they are heading down towards that March 20th low, you know. So they hit around, 18 pence then. In fact, it's not as bad as that at the moment. They are at 40 pence. But, I mean, the trend in the chart, it looks like, you know, it could be a grind towards that before they start the rally, to be honest. You know.
Yes, okay, right. Cool. I mean, my guess would be they would, if they are going to raise money, and I think it's more than a sporting chance that that's true. Clearly, that would be at a discount. That maybe be more at the level at which they troughed at, and they would hope to form a base above that and move on. But tricky times, you know, tricky times, no doubt. And certainly when you juxtapose, I wasn't going to talk about Pets at Home, but, you know, all you need to do is just look at the share price graphs. Pets at Home, you came up with some quite positive numbers today on the basis that, yes, more people own a pet. But number two is it's a repeat purchase sort of thing. If you've got a pet, you need to buy stuff for it. You'll go to Pets at Home. You're locked in there in terms of just the range they got and just maybe the convenience and everything else. You would expect something like a Pets at Home to continue to trade. All right. You know, there's a level of necessity there, which is not the same for a consumer discretionary business such as Cineworld. And when you add on the debt and everything else, that's why Cineworld's share price looks like it is.
Yeah, I hate to say it, but we, you know, our family are that cliche demographic who just joined a pet-owning family during the lockdown. And we've got a little dog here, but she's lovely. And my wife, literally, every time she goes to Pets at Home for anything, food, she buys a toy. So it's literally, we've got, if we had 20 dogs, they'd have enough toys, put it that way. It's ridiculous. And so I can see why something like Pets at Home are doing well. Because like you said, what I hate really though, like you said, it's a bit of a worry on the sort of ethical side of it is that when people start going back to work, I don't know how those pets are going to survive. We talked to someone when it was eat out to help out to eat out. We went out to a restaurant and we took our dog with us outside, and this waitress said, "Oh, I've just got a dog as well, a little dog like that, sort of cockapoo." And she said, "Trouble is, when I go back to work, my parents go back to work, we won't be there for 9 hours. And I thought, well, you can't just leave a dog in the house for 9 hours. Luckily, I work from home.
No.
And so, you know, I'm not saying whether, first of all, that's a priority, you know, worrying about that. But, yeah, I wonder if after the lockdown, Pets at Home will see a decrease, you know, in these dogs, because people just get rid of their pets, I suppose. And, you know, they can't sort of look after them. But I don't know if it's
sadly
massive.
Yeah. Yeah, no, sadly, you may be right at the margin. I think, though, for me, it reflects, you know, a notion which clearly runs through British society, which is we are a nation of animal lovers.
Yeah.
Clearly, there is a horrible tiny minority where that's not the case.
Mm.
But I would imagine, actually, as part of the sort of the structural shift, the regime shift that's happened, it could well be that actually we are going to be spending more time at home, more time, yeah, hence with pets,
yeah,
and hence pets at home do all right. I mean, I don't own the shares, but you look at that share price romp. I mean, it was 100 and change pence back in the dog days of March, April, and pushing well north of 300 pence currently.
Yeah.
What a share. Who cares about hot tech stocks when you've got pets at home?
Well,
and that's the beauty of the market, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look at that. This time last year, it was at £1.17. £1.17, now we're at £3.56. Whatever. So it's a nice return there in a year.
That's right.
Cool. Anything else? What's happening, Chris?
Well, got to talk about Funding Circle. I mean, Funding Circle, you may have seen the adverts on TV. You know, it's this sort of platform, which, you know, platforms are quite trendy at the moment. And when you sort of throw in sort of fintech and everything else, you think, whoa, this is going to be a mega winner. But, you know, Funding Circle sitting there in the middle, offering generally small and medium-sized enterprises loans, or facilitating them, coordinating them and related. They've had an absolute shocker. This company IPO'd 2-3 years ago, I think about 400 plus pence. Mm. And the shares today are a little more than a tenth of that. Which is in itself a bit of a shocker.
Yeah.
The reason why is that they just struggled to make money. And I think the trouble is that as with any, this is where sort of lending cycles and the economy kick in, it's tough. You know, even as a platform business, what you want as a platform business is actually everything going on in your platform to be profitable and nice and great. And the trouble is, lending to small and medium-sized enterprises, often in some cases micro businesses, is always risky. You know, there's a reason why the high street banks do it carefully or perhaps choose not to do it at all. And the trouble is, I think a lot of the stuff that's come onto Funding Circle has been, sort of questionable in terms of its ultimate quality. What I find interesting, today's numbers say, look, they're still running at a loss. They're not generating cash. It's still very, very messy. And, you know, people, investors are still struggling to understand just what sort of metrics to expect from this company. What they said today also, that they are now the fifth biggest instigator, facilitator of these coronavirus interruption loans, which I thought absolutely amazing, given that every single big bank out there is also sort of the facilitator of these things. So, you know, the sort of the Lloyds and the Barclays and whatever of this world. So they're the fifth, number five on this, which actually sounds great at one level, but it's kind of a bit disturbing at another, because I think they're just chasing business. And there was an interesting stat on their write-up. They talked about how long it took for them to appraise and to sort of give a decision on loans. To appraise a loan took them just over 6 minutes, and to give a decision took 9 seconds. Unbelievable.
That's say your name. No. Yes. It's almost like they say, yes, we'll take you, we need you. That's amazing.
Well, I keep getting emails from them. I run a small micro business. I keep getting emails from them saying, we can offer you £50,000. Well, I don't need it, you know. Yeah. My business is free cash flow profitable. I don't need money from Funding Circle. But that shows the desperation. Almost anything, it's like a sort of a mass, you know, email everyone sort of strategy. So kind of fascinating to be number five on these business interruption loans. I'm not sure, though, that's really where you want to be. It's not that they're taking the credit risk, but it's the sort of the reputational and the facilitation risk and everything else. It's just messy. So Funding Circle shares, when I last looked, were having another poor day. And, you know, they've halved, more than halved in the last few months. But if you look since IPO, it's been an absolute shocker.
Do you know what I find, always, Chris, on results? When you get results, right, and you don't get the financials straight away, you get a bit of blurb, a bit of a chat from the CEO, you know, a couple of paragraphs there. You always know the financials aren't that good, because literally, you know, if the financials can speak for themselves, they will. But you've got, and I always find that, you always a couple of paragraphs from the CEO first explaining the financials before you get the financials, you know, and they never do that if it's good financials. So there we are.
That's a very good insight, actually. I think there's probably a lot of truth in that.
Yeah.
I tell you what struck me from their numbers, and this is also something you've got to watch out for, made-up metrics, or not made-up, sorry, that's a bit too harsh, a sort of non-traditional metrics. Not traditional metrics. So they've got adjusted EBITDA, what they call A-EBITDA. Now, EBITDA itself, we could do a whole podcast on whether EBITDA is good or bad. Put that aside, but as soon as you add the word adjusted to it, suddenly your credibility is halved even further. Adjusted EBITDA is about scraping the barrel as low as you can get. What that sort of means is not proper profits. You know, that's the easy way to say it. So, you know, they're talking about, they're still a loss, they're hoping they're going to get to adjusted EBITDA profitability sometime soon. Well, great, but I'm sorry, if you're an investor, you want a bit more.
I'm looking at that, and they've actually got it there, A-E-B-I-T. I didn't realise they actually added the A, which is nonsense. They added that A to the start to make it look a bit, you know, in a capital letter, and it's ridiculous. But if you go all the way on the bottom, essentially, loss per share is 33 pence versus 8.9 pence last year. So, it's a big drop, isn't it, really? So,
it is. Yeah. And the way I would look at it, I mean, another simplistic way, back in the day, you know, Benjamin Graham, who was Warren Buffett's teacher, he would also always talk about book value. Now, in today's world, that's not so relevant. But, you know, for things like banks or financial businesses, it's not a bonkers metric to look at. Yeah. So if you look at net asset value, I think it was 211 million quid, which if I looked at the market cap this morning, it was about the same. So it's trading at about book value, which, to be honest, is not particularly attractive. Not when you're making losses. So yeah.
So ideally, you'd like to see it below that.
I think book value is a funny old thing, and certainly for a fintech business, you can point to many fintech businesses which are trading at massive multiples of book value. Today, at the moment, you can buy any large high street bank you like below half book value. So you've got sort of a couple of metrics to think about. And, you know, this is not a sort of a full-on fintech business, but and it's also not a full-on bank. It's sort of, it's this strange sort of platform hybrid type thing. And my view is that it's loss-making. Should it be trading below net asset values? I think the reality is it probably should.
Yeah. Well, if you look at that, I mean, I'm looking at the cash flow here, and the cash equivalents at the end of this period was 131 million. Last year was 270 million. So, literally, you know, they've halved their cash, you know, in a year. So, that's very telling, isn't it? Anything else?
It's not good.
No, it's not good.
Quick one on the bus and transport stocks, which I know are quite popular in people's portfolios. You've had some updates from Go Ahead Group and National Express earlier today. Both sort of said the same thing, which is that life is not easy. The utilization and everything is going up, but they're thankful for the government's help. And I think Go Ahead said something on the lines of they were government subsidies meant that they were mildly profitable in recent weeks. And that says it all, really. You've seen the government step in here. But as always, when government steps in with sort of a clear subsidy program, there is a price to pay for that. And the price to pay is less profits because, you know, clearly it would be wrong at many levels for the government to subsidize and then profits to be made and divvied out and whatever. So I think for all these companies, it's the same profile, which is that you're going to have, until you get the other side of the pandemic, you're going to have big restraints on profitability here. And you can see that in their comments and everything. There were some great insights, though. There was some wonderful data from the National Express regulatory news update, which was talking about capacity utilization of like 50%, 60%. Versus norms in various bus networks. But apparently the West Midlands, they're running it at 103% of the previous service. So you've got half the passengers, but more buses. So work out the logic of that.
That sounded like a positive thing then, but they say 100%, that sounded quite good, but obviously it's not. That's good. Cool. Okay.
So, I think that area, you know, you've got to be careful. I own a few shares in First Group, which was a wrong move. But that was on the basis that they were looking to split themselves up. And they may ultimately do that. But the trouble is the price being paid for these businesses and everything is going down because either you're reliant on government subsidy or government goodwill or the fact that governments won't let you make profits because, you know, you've got to either pay back subsidy or respect subsidy. So what I'm trying to say is this is a messy era at the moment. You know, there are other things, better things to be doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was, I just read there in National Express, they said, in the trading statement, they said, our previously guided base case assumed revenue to be around 50% of pre-COVID expectations until the end of August. Okay, so yes, that's not pretty good, is it? It's going to be. Like I said, you know what? I just think me, along with many others, I suppose, are just saying, come on, let's get to the end of this year because we know I've seen many of experts in the field saying pretty much COVID will be over within 6 months, you know, some of the vaccines there are testing quite highly. They have 70% efficacy and they're safe as well, and so they'll take out the first layer, the vulnerable people. They'll vaccine those people, and those people really are what's preventing us all going back to work, of course, because in some way we are connected to someone, you know, who's vulnerable, who will get affected by COVID. And so as long as you can vaccine those people, and they could be done by quarter one, then it'll be fine. So it's just dragging, isn't it, for a long time. And the trouble is, the longer it drags, the deeper the problems we have financially with certain companies. Like say now, you know, this working from home again and not going to work, that's going to hit places like Greggs, for example. A lot of their business is done in city centres, you know, going to be it's just dragging on. The debt piles up, doesn't it? And so it gets hard work.
Yeah,
you know?
That's right. I mean, Greggs are lucky they've got cash on the balance sheet, if I recall, but they're not immune. And you've seen that in the way the shares moved about or their recent updates. I'm going to leave you there with some positive news, because I think you're absolutely right, Justin. You've got to be mindful of what companies are, what they're servicing, what their balance sheet looks like, to an even bigger degree than perhaps historically you would have done. I'm going to leave you with some positive news, though. I picked this up from today's Financial Times. Apparently, just 14% of all British retail investors' assets were in UK equity funds at the end of June. That's down from 23% in 2015 and 40% back earlier in the century in 2003. So, you know, investors, you know, it's good that they're diversifying, going global, and that's right and proper. But that strikes me as a very low percentage. And yeah. I think UK equity market is a bit loveless at the moment. There's some good reasons for that. We've talked about some of them, adding a few others, Brexit, et al, all that gubbins. But, you know, it seems to me when people are pessimistic, that's when you find opportunities. You know, it's the old Buffett saying of, you know, you want if people are pessimistic, then you know, opportunities will arise. So
exactly, the entire world has COVID to deal with. We have COVID and Brexit, and so you can see that our markets are very suppressed and depressed at the moment. So and sooner or later they've got to bounce back once they get beyond that. You know.
That's right. And we have, if you think about mix as well, you know, we have been heavy in energy in terms of, let's say, the FTSE 100, energy and financials, and obviously they've been thematically out of favour. They all kind of, a lot is factored in, I would observe. So in terms of peeking through, thinking about investments, yeah, there are things to be doing. And even though the markets might be messy, you might not want to look at your portfolio, that's all fair enough. But don't give up on it. Don't sort of capitulate at the bottom, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Cheers, Chris. Thanks for that. And speak to you next week.
Sounds good. See you then.
OK, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They're at five. Amiga Diagnostics, up 13% to 80 pence. At four, Valrix, up 18% to 61.75. It's gone nuts recently, that. It's been a, three, four, five bagger. At three, Supply Acme Capital, down 13%.5. At two, it's Open Orphan, down 10% to 16.75. And at one, Integumin, again, done very well of late. Skin is a ticker there. It's down a smidge, 3% to 51.5 pence. All right, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Live Comedy Group. Issue of shares and removal of concert party. At four, Open Orphan, statement reprice movement and press speculation. That's about, of course, some of the big pharma companies using Vivo's live challenge model to test the vaccine. At three, it's the Integumin unveiling of new breath test digital health platform. At two, Tech Capital, Solaris, Mexican distribution agreement. And at one, in fact, most liked is SafeStay, the half-year report, and considering they've gone through a very tough 6 months, as Hervé said, they're doing well, managing money, and they're very confident that the crowds will return, which I believe as well. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.